first presentation is by Allison Niehiser, who's a health scientist at the CDC in the Division of Adolescent and School Health. Her content expertise is in the field of childhood obesity and other chronic diseases and identifies strategies and guidance for schools to address physical activity, nutrition, and obesity. She received a B.S. in Health and Sports Studies and a Bachelor of Arts in Zoology from Miami University and a Master of Public Health from Yale University. She's going to be followed by Michelle Mello, who's a professor of law and public health in the Department of Health Policy and Management, director of the program in law and public health, and chair of the Harvard School of Public Health's Institutional Review Board. She conducts empirical research into issues at the intersection of law, ethics, and health policy, and is the author of more than 80 articles and book chapters on the medical malpractice system, medical errors and patient safety, research ethics, mass tort litigation, the obesity epidemic, pharmaceuticals, and other topics. In 2006, she was the recipient of the Alice S. Hirsch New Investigator Award from Academy Health for outstanding promise in the field of health sciences. And the final speaker on communities is Karen Minyard, who's the executive director of the Georgia Health Policy Center and an associate research professor of public administration and urban studies at Georgia State University. She has her PhD from Georgia State and a master's of nursing from the Medical College of Georgia. She's an advocate for basic restructuring of local healthcare systems to focus on access to care and health status. As director of the Georgia Health Policy Center, Karen is charged with leading the policy, research, and technical assistance programs of the center. I would say in advance that this session is recorded. There are a few more chairs up here in the front, and I'll ask the panelists to sit at the desk here to make further space. Allison?
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me to speak here today. I would like to acknowledge my colleagues in the Division of Adolescent and School Health, ETR Associates, and Pueblo City Schools who co-authored this work. Competitive foods are widely available throughout the school day. Youth are exposed to so many opportunities to eat in just a 7-hour time period. According to a recent survey, 100% of high schools reported having at least one competitive food venue, and 55% of high school students reported consuming at least one competitive food from these venues on a typical school day. The most popular food items, desserts, and high-fat, high-calorie snacks. Even when healthier options are available, they're still competing with these unhealthy snacks that are priced to sell. So what can be done to influence students to purchase healthier foods? Well, we heard from Dr. Frieden, Dr. Brownell, and Secretary Sebulis about pricing strategies. The goal of pricing strategies is to motivate students to purchase the healthier food items by decreasing the price to make that food item more attractive. Dr. Simone French and her colleagues at the University of Minnesota consistently demonstrated a pricing strategy increased fruit, carrots, and low-fat snack food sales using in both work sites and in high schools. So, in other words, if you offer healthier foods and make them cheaper, people and even kids will purchase them. Now, to offset any revenues, Dr. French and her colleagues also were able to demonstrate that if you increase the price of some popular unhealthy snack foods, you're able to offset the price and maintain revenue. So we decided to go beyond the experimental setting and bring this strategy to a school district, bring it to scale. Is this feasible for a school district to implement? We wanted to evaluate the process of adopting and implementing a pricing strategy in three competitive food venues in the school setting, whereas previous work only looked at one competitive food venue exclusively. This pricing strategy was completely implemented and led by the school district, where CDC and ETR and associates provided some technical assistance and evaluated the process. We selected Pueblo City Schools as the school district, with a medium-sized school district with 5 high schools. 4 high schools implemented the pricing strategy. About 63% free reduced price lunch for the student demographics and about 60% Hispanic students. Pueblo City Schools had recently adopted their local wellness policy, indicating that at every competitive food venue, about 50% of foods offered had to be healthy options. So while Pueblo was very interested in offering these healthier options, they also did not want to compromise any revenue that they might have received through competitive food sales. So a pricing strategy was very attractive to them. The pricing strategy intervened in the a la carte, vending machines, and at the school stores. It was fully led by the district nutrition services. It was not mandated in the policy, but they just received buy-in from the principals who said that they would implement this pricing strategy at their schools. The price change strategy occurred over 4 months from February 2007 to May 2007 with baseline data collected in January 2007. The prices of select healthy items were decreased about 2 to 3 items per venue. These included fresh fruit, baked chips, popcorn, Chex Mix, nuts, animal crackers, pretzels, low-fat yogurt, and corn nuts. They were all among the 2 to 3 items selected per school. The prices of select less healthy items were increased. And so, again, was about 2 to 3 items per venue at each school. Less healthy items included all the candy, donuts, muffins, cupcakes, cookies, chips, yogurt dip bars, and a cup of soups. Beverages were intentionally excluded as requested by the school district. They didn't think it was feasible at the time to implement the strategy on the beverages. Healthy and less healthy items were defined by the nutrition standards stated in Pueblo's wellness policy, which was consistent with the recent state standards for competitive food policies. This table demonstrates how the prices were increased for the healthier prices were decreased for the healthier items and increased for the less healthy items. The rate of increase and decrease was determined based on both Dr. French's literature and her previous work, but also based on what the stakeholders felt were feasible. So what the school store advisors, the cafeteria staff, and the vendors thought was easy to implement and convenient for making change. Also note that a la carte lines and school stores had to sell fruit as part of this pricing strategy. School stores had never sold fruit prior to this strategy, and they weren't sure really how to obtain the fruit, and so the school district nutrition services director was critical in linking up the school stores with the cafeteria so the school stores could purchase the fruit directly from the cafeteria, and so this helped them address demand issues, and so the school stores could purchase as much or as little as they needed based on demand and also limit potential waste. The evaluation of this case study was to look at the process of adopting and implementing this pricing strategy, find out what the reactions are of the key stakeholders, like the principals, the school store advisors, the cafeteria staff, vendors, students, district nutrition services staff, et cetera, and also to collect some data on sales and revenue data. We conducted environmental observations, collected sales and revenue data. We did interview data and focus group data. So what contributed to the successful implementation of this pricing strategy? Number one, there was support from the director of nutrition services at the district level. She was the individual that really championed this approach and strategy and also was able to get buy-in from the principals to implement this strategy. Two, the wellness policy set the stage at the district level for implementing such approach, for identifying a way to feasibly increase the number of healthy options sold at the competitive food venues. And third, the stakeholders actually reported that this was quite an easy process to implement, which was a surprise to us despite the training they needed for data collection and how to select food items and what to increase and decrease in price. The easiest venue to implement this strategy was actually the a la carte lines, and that was because it was led by the director of nutrition services, so she was fully committed. It was also a fully automated system, so the price change strategy only involved changing the computer program in the cash registers. And also the a la carte lines had already begun implementing more healthier options per the local wellness policy, so they're kind of already on the track of offering healthier foods. What were some of the barriers to putting this strategy in place? First, the timing of the intervention. It was implemented halfway through the school year, so the students were very aware of the price increases of the less healthy foods. And so this would probably have been, it would probably be more ideal to implement a strategy such as this when school was out of session, so maybe during the summer months. Another barrier was really coordinating across all the competitive food venues, especially with the school stores. School stores were run independent of the school district nutrition services. And so they weren't used to receiving mandates from the district level on what type of food they should sell and at what price they should sell it at. And there was also some trouble with training them for like data collection, et cetera. The school stores are actually led by faculty advisors for the students' business and marketing clubs. And so the school store acts kind of like as a fundraiser for those clubs. And so they were just not usually in coordination and communication with the district-level nutrition services. One thing to note is after a year of follow-up, the school stores did not maintain the pricing strategy, and they removed all fruit sales. And they actually kept the high prices and just raised all the healthier foods to a higher price. Thank you. But the a la carte lines maintain the pricing strategy, and actually there's three outside vending companies, and one of the vending companies was statewide, and the vendor actually was so impressed with the strategy that he implemented it in all of his vending machines across the city. So with the decrease of healthier options and increase of price of less healthy options. Here's after 3 months of data collection, here are some of the results of the sales data. And what we see is a trend in the direction of an increase in sales of the healthier food items from 7% at baseline to 11% in April, and a trend in a decrease of sales of less healthier snacks sold from 51% at baseline to about 43% after 3 months of data collection. So this really kind of reiterates that if you sell the healthier foods at a lower price, students will purchase them. One thing also that was interesting was that overall sales, so all the sales of the healthier food items, regardless of if they were affected by the pricing strategy, actually increased, and all the sales of the less healthy items, regardless of if they were affected by the pricing strategy, decreased. Like most districts, there was concern about any potential loss in profits, and so this table demonstrates the net profit of all the competitive foods who were involved in the pricing strategy. This is the daily average profit per student, and as you can see, the profits fluctuated over the 3 months of data collection and eventually decreased. However, the district nutrition services director actually mentioned that this is probably very minimal and wouldn't have much of an impact on the sales data. And the school store advisors commented that this might have actually been expected fluctuations seen across the school year. So with this evaluation of a case study of bringing a pricing strategy to scale at a school district, we were able to identify some guidance for decision makers. First, you really need to identify a coordinator at the school level to oversee all food sales so that there's one individual that knows what's happening at all competitive food venues, such as the school stores, so they're not independent of all the nutrition services, and also to monitor and make sure that all the venues are in compliance with the guidelines. Second, develop communication between the district administrators and the stakeholders. You have to remember that policy cannot be implemented overnight. You really need to communicate what the policy is, how to do it. That might even involve training. Also, bringing together all the venues that are going to be affected by the pricing strategy is important. Even the vendors commented that they would like to meet with the other venues so that they would have less redundancy of the food items sold across all the venues. Implement a strategy everywhere competitive foods are offered. One of the barriers was that fundraisers were not implemented or did not receive the pricing strategy, and the school stores were actually pretty upset when the other outside fundraisers were selling candy at a lower price than what they were able to sell the candy at. implemented at the beginning of the school year, like I mentioned, when school is out of session before students begin, and involves stakeholders in the food selection. Remember, students are the ones purchasing the food, so involve them in the food selection of the healthier options and what to identify to receive the price increases as well. And final guidance is really support the changes through nutrition education. Students like to be aware of why things change. This can also create more buy-in. Also, you might want to consider adding prompts to market the lower prices of the healthier foods. Dr. French found that they were able to increase slightly the effectiveness of their pricing strategy by adding marketing and prompts. Integrate the strategy into policy. This really helps you to make the changes across all the venues and to sustain the change. So if this was in policy, the school stores would not have been able to revert to their old practices. They would have had to continue on. Also, policy is a way to establish some nutritional guidelines as well. And finally, you need to maintain a long-term commitment to the strategy in order to create a healthier environment for all students so that the healthy choice becomes the easy choice. One last thing. So pricing strategies really influence students to purchase healthier foods, and we demonstrated that this is feasible for a school district to implement. If schools continue to sell competitive foods, you need to offer and promote the healthy foods so that students can be healthy and productive learners. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
And as you will hear from these three papers, they're quite different takes on incentives. And the next paper by Michelle Mello is The Use of Financial Incentives in Workplace Wellness Programs, What Does the Law Allow?, which is a very tricky and highly relevant issue within work sites. Michelle?
I'm disappointed that my slides have somehow stretched out to be wider than they ordinarily look at a conference like this.
It's an obesity conference,
yeah, exactly. But nevertheless, I'm happy to be here to talk about this. It's a topic that I've been interested in for a couple of years after I started hearing from a number of large corporations about their musings about whether initiatives that would give financial penalties or rewards for people for engaging in healthy behaviors bumped up against anti-discrimination law. And lately, this topic, as you know, has been in the news a lot. Just in the last 2 weeks, we've seen a bill come out of the Senate Health Committee that would, as the Senator talked about yesterday, liberalize what companies are able to offer in terms of discounts on insurance premiums. We heard President Obama mention in his recent press conference on health reform how impressed he was with Safeway's initiatives along these lines. And there just is a tremendous amount of interest on both sides of the political aisle, as well as in the House and the Senate, in going in this direction towards encouraging wellness and prevention programs. So the question of what the law allows, and more recently, whether the law ought to be changed to encourage the further growth of these programs is very timely. I want to give you the basic lay of the land as it is now, but just sort of flag that this is an issue that's very much in play. And depending on which version of the health reform bill actually makes it through, we may begin to see some targeted changes in what the law allows in the direction of making it easier to do these kinds of things. The programs that I'll talk about today really run the gamut of these types of incentives that might be provided to insured individuals or employees. What they have in common is that some reward or penalty, and often it's just a matter of framing, really, whether you describe something as a surcharge or a bonus, for example, for engaging in healthy behaviors or meeting a particular health standard, like achieving a certain body mass index or getting a blood sugar level down to a particular level. Most of the initiatives so far have been in the direction of providing some kind of cash or in-kind benefits. But the more controversial programs actually condition the amount or ability to get health insurance coverage on the willingness to participate in a wellness initiative. And the most controversial type of program at all actually condition the ability to get hired or promoted on the ability to maintain a certain kind of health standard. So I'll talk briefly about each of those kinds of programs. The prevalence of these initiatives among large employers and to a lesser extent among small employers is really growing. These are the latest data from a survey of large employers last year, illustrating that over 3/4 of these employers had some kind of health or wellness program in place, and typically these are operated through their group health plans if they do offer insurance to their employees. And of those, about 71% had some kind of financial incentive surrounding participation in that wellness program. And that proportion that were using financial incentives was up from 62% in 2007, and it was an even larger jump from 2006. So we see really great interest in this, particularly among the large employers. So what can we do? Let me give you three hypothetical examples based on real-life programs. Example one, a financial services firm announces it is no longer going to hire overweight persons. Legal or illegal? Example two, a group health plan offers to give everybody who participates in a nutrition class a $100 cash bonus. Okay, and number three, a group health plan offers a 25% discount on your health insurance premium if you keep yourself at a healthy weight. Okay, I'm hearing mixed answers. Let me go through these in turn. The first example is clearly the most draconian. I also want to point out that in this particular example, the restriction on hiring is unrelated to your ability to do the job, right? Last time we checked, investment bankers didn't do a lot of heavy lifting, either figuratively or literally. And so no need to maintain a trim physique in order to do the job. Nevertheless, Penny Packer decides it wants to save money after the recent downturn in the financial markets and is going to screen out high-cost employees. The main law that's implicated here is the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, which applies to all private employers with 15 or more employees. There's a counterpart, an older law called the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. Essentially, the same provisions apply to the federal government and any program that receives federal funds. And the basics of those laws essentially ask, you know, are you covered? If so, are you talking about some kind of a condition or disability that relates to the person's ability to do the job? The laws are going to give you a break there. Clearly, if you have a condition that morbid obesity would, a job that you would be prevented from doing by morbid obesity, that's going to be different than being an investment banker. But assuming we're not in that zone, the courts are essentially going to ask whether the condition that, on the basis of which the person's being discriminated against, constitutes a qualifying disability under the terms of the law. What does that mean? Well, these laws define a disability as a mental or physical impairment that substantially limits your ability to engage in one or more major life activities, like working or walking or having children. Or you have had a history of such a condition, or you are regarded as having such a condition. A few courts have actually been asked to opine about whether overweight or obesity meets this definition. The statute doesn't tell us itself, nor do the regulations. And the courts have generally agreed that just moderate obesity is not going to trigger this condition of disability. It's not a substantial impairment of any major life activity. But severe or morbid obesity is a different matter, and here we see some split among the courts. Some of the lower federal courts have opined that because very heavy people tend to be stigmatized, tend to be regarded as less able on the job than those who are of lower weight, that we should consider them to be regarded as having a disability. And so on this basis, they have opined that severe obesity would be a qualifying disability. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that brings ADA claims on behalf of workers, has taken the position that severe or morbid obesity is always a disability under the ADA. But the leading and most recent Federal Circuit Court of Appeals decision on this topic went the other way. It involved a moving company, Watkins Motor Lines. It employed a 400-pound truck driver who underwent a mandatory company physical, and the doctor said, you're no longer able to do this job because of your weight. He was fired and he sued. And the court then took the interesting tack of saying, in this case, the guy's obesity doesn't qualify as a disability because it doesn't have a physiological cause. But if you show me a plaintiff who's very obese and can give me a medical reason, a physiological reason why he is that way, then I would be inclined to consider that a disability. So the upshot of this is the courts give us very inconsistent signals at this point about when obesity will qualify for protection under the ADA. And so that leaves employers in a little bit of a haze. It's likely that they would prevail in a suit like Watkins Motor Lines, but it's not certain, and it seems likely that the EEOC would take an interest in any case along those lines. To muddy the waters further, there's state law. As you heard a little bit about yesterday, the Elliott-Larsen Civil Rights Act in Michigan explicitly protects overweight individuals against discrimination by their employer. So this would not fly in Michigan, the Penny Packer policy. Other states also have general disability discrimination laws that their courts may interpret more broadly to encompass at least severe obesity. So the Penny Packer policy is not clearly legal. It's probably legal in most states at this time, but an employer does run some legal risk associated with a strategy like that. What about the second policy? So this is the relatively benign policy of just giving anyone who participates in a nutrition class, whether they lose weight or make changes in their eating habits or not, $100. And you all thought this seemed legal. Well, this actually turns out to be more complicated than you'd think. I started wading into this thinking there'd be sort of one or two laws that I'd have to look through to get the answer here, and it turns out that it really is a thicket of interacting state and federal laws and regulations. Because this is a group health plan, not just the Americans with Disabilities Act, but also HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, is in play here. That applies to all group health plans. You probably have heard of that as a not very good privacy law. It also has non-discrimination provisions that have applicability here. And the basic framework there is it applies to any group health plan scheme that affects the design or the cost of benefits to the insured person, which this Inatrode policy clearly would. The general rule is that HIPAA bans what's called list billing, meaning that it can't charge us as individuals different amounts for our insurance in a group health plan depending on our health history or having a health factor. You have to treat all similarly situated employees the same. So if you're a full-time employee, you get one price. If you're part-time, another price. If you work for a certain company, you might get a different price, but not tied to health factors. The exception is if the company operates a bona fide wellness program that meets certain requirements. So if they do that, then there's a further classification, and I basically divide it into three categories. Things that are clearly illegal are things that just condition the price of insurance on the basis of a health factor, regardless of the existence of a wellness program. So if I just announce as the Inatrode CEO, tomorrow all diabetics are paying twice as much for their insurance, they're costing me a lot of money, not legal under HIPAA. The yellow light category, sort of proceed with caution, are programs that condition a reward on attaining a health standard in the context of a wellness program. And then the green light programs are programs that give people a reward or impose a penalty on the basis of their participation in a wellness program, not for achieving a health standard. And that's clearly where the Inatrode policy falls. So you're all right, your intuition is very correct there, but that program is legal. The harder policy is the Vandalay Industries policy, which says you've got to maintain a healthy weight in order to get this fairly considerable discount on your insurance. That puts us in the yellow light category for a couple of reasons. So we're talking about a group health plan here. It's discriminating against a health on the basis of a health factor. And so in order to survive, the employer of the health plan has got to have to show a few different things. Number one, the reward has to be limited to just 20% of the coverage. So right here, Vandalay Industries fails because it's offering a 25% reward. This is where Senator Harkin's bill is pushing right now. It wants to raise this limit to 30%, as you heard, while authorizing the secretary to raise it up to 50%. So big rewards potentially on the horizon, but as of now, it has to be 20% of the cost of the coverage for the employee and the employer combined. So what they both pay for that employee, 20% of that is the maximum. You also have to have a bona fide wellness program that is reasonable in its design. You have to let people try for the reward at least annually. And here's the kicker. You have to make it available to everybody. And if somebody comes back to you with plausible reason why they can't achieve that health standard because of a medical condition, you have to give them a reasonable alternative standard. What does this mean? Not entirely clear. It's clear that in cases like if I say to my employees, anyone who maintains their weight for 12 months gets the discount, and I have a pregnant employee come to me, I'm going to have to offer her some kind of alternative arrangement since it wouldn't be safe for her to maintain her weight. But whether people might be able to say, well, look, I'm addicted to nicotine, and so it's not safe for me to stop smoking, just cold turkey or something of that nature, very unclear. And you have to make the availability of this alternative standard public so your employees know they don't actually have to achieve the standard to get the reward. They just have to try and then meet this alternative standard. So Vandelay's plan failed on two counts. Number one, it exceeds that 20% threshold. Number two, there's no indication that there's any kind of reasonable alternative standard that has been offered. So the Vandelay program would fail under current law, but again, if things open up, that might be the kind of program we'd see more of in the future. So what is the future currently looking like? If you look at the industry and where private industry is currently going now within the bounds of the law, a few sort of interstices are being fleshed out. One is that we'll see more and more of these kinds of programs penetrating down to the smaller employers. It's a nice intersection of cost control and the so-called consumer-directed healthcare movement. Lots of people have already bought into the notion that we should be giving consumers more skin in the game when it comes to their healthcare, and this is just a nice way to do it. We'll continue to see these initiatives largely being in the context of voluntary wellness programs. Not a lot of companies interested in firing people for being overweight at this point in time. More interested in giving out cash and subsidies. We'll mostly, I think, continue to see relatively modest rewards, but if we get a signal from Congress that this is going to be liberalized, I expect we'll see more companies following suit. And I think we'll continue to see predominantly activity or participation-based rewards rather than rewards that are conditioned on achieving a health standard. And I think that's in part because of employers' uncertainty about what the law requires, that this sort of yellow light zone is very murky to them, and they feel safer just offering the $100 for the gift card, even though, you know, behavioral research suggests that a lot of these programs will not achieve their intended outcome. We might, from a performance perspective, want to actually target the achievement of a health standard rather than just participation in an activity. This requirement to provide some kind of reasonable alternative standard is likely to stick, and that may really undercut the effectiveness of a lot of these programs, again, because people will say, well, I realize I don't actually have to achieve the goal. If I just show up to the Weight Watchers meeting, that'll get me the reward. And finally, what emerges from the corporate sector is a strong, almost religious belief in the effectiveness of these programs in terms of their return on investment, but very little in the way of formal evaluation, very, very little in the way of best practices or really understanding what works in terms of behavior change. Senator Harkin mentioned that in his bill, that kind of program evaluation is a very central part, and I think that's something that the industry will really appreciate. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Our final presentation is by Karen Minyard, and her focus is building systems thinking capacity with state policymakers as a way to answer the question, how do we engage state policymakers in change? Karen?
For a number of years, I've been interested in helping people to think systematically about health issues, and it has been a thing that I've thought about in terms of a broad group of stakeholders. How can you think systematically rather than about health, rather than thinking about individual siloed issues? And so I was speaking with the president of the Woodruff Foundation and trying to get him to invest with us in doing this work. And he said, well, Karen, I'd be happy to invest in this if you will do it with state legislators, if you'll teach state legislators to think systematically. And my heart kind of sank when he said that, because I thought that he was giving me a pretty hard task. But Rachel and Marianne and I decided that we were going to take it on, and we talked to the chairs of our Senate and health committees. And they agreed that it would be a good thing for the legislators to think systematically. So we entered into a partnership with some of the leaders in our Georgia legislature and began to think about how this would happen. And what we found is that the legislators divided themselves into different learning groups. Those who wanted to know what the letters mean, like what is an HMO or what is Medicaid versus Medicare. Those who wanted to know more about individual issues. Those in a third category who wanted to know a lot, that they were willing to put some time in, and if they could have a master's in health policy, they'd really like to have that. And then those who are in the leadership positions who need enough to know enough not to be dangerous. And so we focused in on programs for each of those learning levels. And the one that I want to talk to you about today is the program where we focused on those who really wanted to learn more. The legislators told us that there were probably 10 to 30 people in our legislature, 10 to 30 legislators, who would be willing to participate in a certificate program to help them learn about health policy and about thinking systematically. And so we designed this program. There were eight sessions, eight half-day sessions offered once a month over about 9 months. We chose the topics based on the priorities of the participants and some things that we thought were important for them to learn. And they had to complete a certain number of the sessions in order to receive the certificate. We had about 30 legislators who participated in our first round, and half of them participated in enough of the sessions to receive a certificate. And the sessions, there were four basic sessions that had to do with systems thinking, what is health, healthcare financing, and then healthcare coverage and access. Then we had deeper dives in four areas that included more on financing. Of course, they wanted to know more about that. Mental health, childhood obesity, and trauma. And what I want to focus in on today is the work that we did around childhood obesity. So when we thought about teaching these legislators about systems thinking, we thought of it in terms of different levels of work. So there was a system thinking that had to do with just applying basic conversational skills. Then there was another level of building simple maps. And then there was the level of building computer simulation models. And we thought about, with this group, all of these different levels. I wonder what they're talking about. So at the conversational level, what anybody can do, what all the legislators could do, was to talk in terms of basic, important questions. And we used these questions to help them think about all of the issues. And this turned out to be very important. The chair of our health committee asked that these questions be used by the majority whip to evaluate any bills that came to her committee in the future, as opposed to the other questions that they were using. And these look at things beyond just how much does something cost, to thinking about what's the important trend, looking at it over time, what are the unintended consequences, who are the stakeholders that would be involved in this. And so we use this framework in every session and kept repeating this. Another thing that happened with this is when we were doing a briefing with the various provider groups in our state that come together in a council, the hospitals, the physicians, the nurses, the pharmacists, their trade association leaders, when we were giving them a briefing about this work, they said, wait a minute, we want to see those six questions. Tell us exactly what they are. We're going to develop our arguments and our proposals to the legislators using those six questions. And that seems like a really good thing to me, because that gets everybody talking at a more sophisticated level about issues. They also asked us if we would put together an abbreviated certificate program for some of their members to attend, which I think is another way that we'll have better policy conversations. So right off the bat, when you think about, typically legislators are responding to events or maybe patterns of behavior, not usually thinking about delving deeper into the systemic structure or into the mindset things that would have more leverage. But right off the bat, when the chair of the health committee said, use these questions to evaluate the bills, she was getting deep into the opportunity to have leverage by changing a systemic structure that made a difference in how they work together in the legislature. The next level is drawing simple maps, and this is a very nice version of a map that was very messy in the room with the legislators. And in this, we have the boxes, which are the buckets of healthy, at-risk, and chronically ill folks. And in between are, you can think of them as faucets that allow people to flow from the buckets. And the legislators talked about what causes a person to move from being healthy to being at risk. Well, they start smoking, or they quit exercising, or something like that. And then how do they get back to being in the healthy and safe population? And one of the legislators said, well, they would lose weight, or they would exercise, or they would quit smoking. And one of the legislators said, well, I am morally opposed to the state paying for a person to lose weight. And one of the other legislators said, well, Joe, the way I look at it is you can pay me now or you can pay me later. And if you pay me later, you're going to pay me more. And it turned out that Pay Me Now or Pay Me Later became the title of the prevention session that we had at the legislative biennial, where a larger group of legislators came to hear from their peers who now had a different kind of appreciation for prevention. And one of the things they told us in the evaluation of the work is that they think about prevention now in a different way. And so this exercise of working with how this folks flow through these buckets was very helpful. The other thing that happened with this is on the FAR bucket, we mapped the money, like how does the money flow around these buckets? And it turns out that all the money is at the far end. You pay for people who are chronically ill, you extend their lives, and then you continue to pay for them longer, and it's a reinforcing loop of investment. And when they started to try to identify what's the money that we have down at the other end, they said, ooh, we don't have much money there. Maybe we need to think about how we can put some money there, because that will make a difference. So when you think about this systems thinking, there's the conversational skills with asking the questions. There's the simple stock and flow map that we just looked at. There's the simple model that I'm going to show you right now. And then there are the more complex models, even moving into the mother of all models, which typically is not done in time to be helpful to a current question. So when you think about this issue, there are folks, and there are probably some of you in the room, who think, well, it's a model, the world's too complex, our situation is unique, and you can find all kinds of things that make the model not apply. Equally problematic, and some of you probably fall in this category, are those who think the model can predict the future, and if you can just get everything in the model, it will be perfect. And what we're proposing is that as you look at this, you think as a realist, and that all the time we're using models to make decisions. And this is a tool for all of us to get our mental models out on the table and compare them and be able to have a more rigorous discussion. It makes our assumptions explicit. So all models are wrong. Some are useful. And so what I'd like to do is show you this model. And okay. I've been promising the model and she couldn't get it to pull up. Well, afterwards, if anybody wants to see it, I'll show it to you on my computer individually. But what we had was a situation where, in parallel to this education program that was happening for the legislators, we were building the model. Several of the legislators said, we want to participate and our staff will participate. And then we had nutritionists, epidemiologists, physical activity experts, economists, some names of folks that you might know from association with CDC, Ken Powell and Rick Trowbridge were involved in the design of this. These folks worked together to design the model, and they developed the and here's the list of the people that participated in it. And the model looks at the issue of non-obese children, at-risk children, and looks at the impact of various policies on their calorie imbalance, which changes their weight, so that kids can move from being normal weight to being obese or vice versa. And it looks at how children move over time. And this is a complicated display of that. But what I want to focus in on is the issues, the policy options. Now, the group identified probably 30 policy options that were possible to think about related to childhood obesity. And they either lumped them together or narrowed them down so that there would be six main options. And these were options that they chose because they thought, the legislators thought, they might be able to do something about these, or because we had the data that we needed in order to create the model. And so what we have is a community-based safe routes to school option, a medical care option, which is nutrition therapy, a la carte foods in schools, minutes in physical education, preschool programs, and after-school programs. And when you see the model, it looks like this. And on the right, you can see for children, what is the prediction based on the work that's been done at the CDC of children in the future, and that they will remain at a dangerously high, almost 25% obesity. On the left, you can see where the children are divided into their age categories. The green line is the middle school age children, and you can see that from going down. At the bottom, you have this opportunity to implement different options. And what we said to the legislators was, what would you like to see? What's the option that you would like to implement? And then they worked with someone who knew how to run the model and tested out, implemented different options, and decided what they thought they would like to do. And this is an implementation of a model that you can see on here. It includes the community-based policy. It's a combination model. It includes increasing the quality of after-school programs. It includes the preschool programs. And it includes changing some things related to physical activity. Well, it's really a combination of all of them because it also includes the school nutrition. So in this, if you implemented those, then you can see that the amount of childhood obesity over 10 years would be greatly decreased. There's also a component to the model that helps us begin to look at money and the cost savings of this. The legislators told us that this made a big difference for them in their conversations. They had some arguments over whether they could implement certain things. They said they really liked being able to rerun the model in real time, because what happens for them is that they have something, somebody's presenting them data, they have a question. The person says, well, okay, I'll go away and run and get that information for you. They come back in a month, and the legislator says, now, what was the question again? And so this helped them in real time answer questions. They said that it gave them confidence with their constituents to say, I know this might not seem popular, but I know that in 10 years it's going to make a difference. And they liked the fact that they were able to look at it with Republican, Democrat, House, and Senate together having conversations that used information that they trusted because their colleagues had been a part of developing it.
Thank you.
We have some time for questions. Because this session is being recorded, please use the mic and introduce yourself.
Hi, Laurie Witzler with the American Heart Association. This question I have is really based on financial incentives in the workplace. It's an issue that we've been integrally involved with on Capitol Hill in the discussions around health care reform. And there seems to be this you know, as I've talked to others at the conference about this issue, like an implicit support within the public health community for incentives tied to healthcare premiums. And we've tried to take a more nuanced position on this on the Hill, where we're for financial incentives, especially those paid directly to employees, but definitely concerned about incentives that are tied to the deductible or healthcare premiums for different reasons related to access to care and privacy issues, et cetera. What we've had to battle, obviously, the Safeway example that's on the Hill. And my question to you is, and I think you did, you know, you raised the point in your presentation that there's not a lot of research done on the outcomes of these types of programs like Safeway. Can you point to any research? Can you give any evidence that programs like Safeways are making an impact?
Well, it's not my field, so I'll defer to others who work in this area. But when I wrote this paper with my colleague who's a behavioral economist a year ago, we did a literature scan, and there was really nothing spot on. There was some related literature that suggests, you know, the bigger the incentive, the more people respond, and they tend to respond to penalties more than rewards, and some fairly intuitive things. But in terms of specific programs and what the returns on investments are, they're all anecdotal reports, to my knowledge, done by the programs themselves, by program administrators who have a pretty vested interest in showing their success. And I see Steve's lining up, maybe has something further to contribute along these lines. But I'm not a behavioral person myself, so I'll just end my answer there.
No, I appreciate that. Thanks. And we've struggled ourselves to find that information, and we're still searching for it. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Ginny Sims. I'm a wellness director for an employee benefits specialist, and so I'm out on the corporate setting trying to implement and design wellness plans. So my question for you is kind of a follow-up to that about incentives. With tying the reward to healthcare premiums, what's your view on that? I know you addressed that a little bit earlier, but, you know, again, keeping it as more of the carrot rather than the stick, and what's the legality of that?
So, I think I've covered the broad outlines of the legality of that, which is that you can do it if you adhere to these basic safe harbors that are outlined in HIPAA. I too would rather see it tied to a premium than to a deductible, because we know that people forego necessary care in order to avoid those deductibles, but they're less likely, I think, to forego insurance altogether. The way I tend to view these things is that if it is a discount, nobody is worse off except in terms of relative deprivation. If you compare it to the status quo, no one's made worse off by these programs. And so it's hard to be against them. But what I would like to see is some controlled experimentation that would give us some answers about price elasticity of these behaviors.
Hi, Steve Gartmaker, Harvard School of Public Health. The first paper was talking about school-based program, and you mentioned that they didn't do anything about beverages, and you said they didn't because they didn't have enough time. Is that the only reason, or is it because the schools or the people are making so much money off of the beverages?
No, actually, to clarify, there was a lot of pushback from the school stores and the vendors to include the beverages, and since this strategy was purely led by the school district, all the decisions were made by the school district, and so the school district moved forward with that. One anecdotal item was that the after the intervention was implemented, one of the school store advisors just decided to increase all of their beverages, just add more increases to the price because they thought they would get more revenue out of it, but they didn't do anything different between the healthy and less healthy beverages. So, unfortunately, that's why it was not implemented.
Interesting. It's complicated. It was a nice study. Just a quick follow-up.
Please.
To Michelle. I mean, are there legal issues about manipulating prices like that in school settings?
Not to my knowledge, but it's not something I've studied.
You have looked at sugar-sweetened beverages in schools, but those are just around restrictions.
There are contractual obligations between schools and these companies. Once they get themselves into these contracts, they have to see them through or come to a mutually agreeable amendment to the contract. But that doesn't mean that during the next contracting period they can't agree on some other terms. And whether those agreements cover price and at what level of detail, I don't know.
And this is also competitive food venues, too. So these they were able to set their prices anyway at the competitive food venue level.
Thank you. Karen, you know, what you in effect have done is to provide legislators with a strategy that hopefully would incent them to look more critically at some of these health policy changes. Do you have any data about whether that effectively happened? What happened to these high performers who went through the program? Were they more likely to introduce legislation? Was the legislation more related to the targets that you established?
Well, they had had battles over the last few years to do something about childhood obesity, and they had been unsuccessful in coming up with anything that they could agree on. This session, they actually did pass legislation that enforced the rules that are on the books related to children's PE. And because that showed up in the model as being something that, I'm not saying that's because why they did it, but it did show up in the model as something that could make a difference. And one of the key legislators got onto it and said, you know, this wouldn't cost us any more money, and it looks like it would make a big difference. They also implemented fitness testing. So this is something that we have thought a lot about. We sent people to sit in on the committees of all the legislators and to watch and listen to what they said in the committees and to see if they used any of the language that we were teaching them. And you know, sometimes they did a little bit, but you can't tell, and they talk in the hall, and you don't know. But when they thought about legislation and then they're able to come up with something and it seems to be related, then we think maybe it had some impact.
I'm MJ Patterson from New York State. I had a question about the school study. I just want a clarification. At one point you said that the kids were really surprised because in the middle of the year the prices went up and they were very aware of that. And then later you said that there was some effort to tell, you know, that there was some effect about telling, doing some social marketing. And what I wasn't clear about is whether you told kids in January food's going to be cheaper and this other kind of food is going to be more expensive, or if you didn't tell them that and let them just notice it by themselves.
Yes, apologize for the misunderstanding. What I was referring to at the end was actually Simone French's study, where they actually implemented both a pricing intervention as well as prompts, labeling the foods, low-fat snacks, and also putting up messages that stated that the lower fat items were for sale. So we did not do this. We did not include that in this study.
My question is for Karen Minyard. I'm Rachel Ballard Barbash from the National Cancer Institute. NCI has funded some work in this area in terms of cancer control. I was intrigued by the six questions you pulled together, which make great sense for those of us who look at data all the time and try to understand it. But how did you arrive at those six questions, and did you work with the legislators at all to try to determine if those were some of the issues that they were trying to get answers to?
Well, we had a few of the questions that we had been using as part of a primer for legislators for a few years, but we wanted to expand it, and we worked with the systems engineer to really build back from a systems model to what are the kind of questions you need to answer in order to be able to really think systematically about a problem, and how do you think more broadly. And we worked to develop them and presented them to the legislators, and they accepted them. We didn't include them in deciding what they would be.
Did you get a sense on whether legislators who may have been quite involved or entrepreneurs in business, who might have a tendency to think more deeply about some issues in business as to try to interpret why they might have increase in revenues or not? I mean, that would be an intriguing question, I think, because my sense is if you look at economics and business models, people are looking at some of these issues and whether there's a way to have them understand those applications to help.
We did have legislators who were business people in the sessions that we did. But I couldn't tell a difference. It seems like they all kind of learned together and sort of accepted this way of thinking and began to use this new language pretty much together. I didn't notice that the business leaders latched right onto it.
Please join me in thanking this panel for giving me this.